Chapter 1. A question you don't yet know to ask. Jason Asano and his team of fellow adventurers were living in a houseboat literally made of clouds. At a marina in the city of Greenstone, it was moored amidst the pleasure craft of Greenstone's wealthy and aristocratic elite. The Cloud House had been the much-vied-for prize in the Reaper Trials, a deadly contest in an otherworldly realm. Jason and his teammates had managed to beat out some of the finest young adventurers in the world. Jason's team had no illusions that they were better than the many outstanding young people they had competed against, knowing that luck and circumstance played a large role in their victory. After a celebratory trip away where they consolidated their gains from the contest, their new objective was training. The young team had experienced success, but they had a long way to go, both as individuals and as a team. Jason and his teammate Humphrey Geller were the first to rise each morning. Jason made the team breakfast while Humphrey plotted out the day's training. As the teams were magical beings transformed by the essences they had all consumed, they were able to sustain themselves on spirit coins and go without food entirely. Humphrey liked the effect on morale and team cohesion that eating breakfast altogether had, while Jason just liked breakfast. When Emir Bahadir had presented Jason with the magical item that created the Cloud House, he had warned that it would be something of a money pit. The Cloud House was capable of reproducing all manner of amenities, from showers to ovens to windows that could function like a telescope. In order to activate these functions, however, Jason needed to supply magical resources, usually in the form of magic quintessence gems, water quintessence for bathroom amenities, fire, iron, and glass for a stove and oven. Jason had already poured a small fortune into it. The ability to call a grill right up out of the deck, the cloud stuff the house was made of, shifting to meet his needs, made Jason think it was completely worth the cost. For someone for whom cooking was such an important part of his life, it was a delightful convenience. "I love being rich," Jason muttered happily, as he flipped hotcakes on the grill.
"What was that?"
Humphrey asked, looking up distractedly.
"Nothing,"
Jason said, raising a clenched fist.
"Seize the means of production."
"What are you talking about?" Humphrey asked.
"Nothing, it's fine," Jason said, turning his attention back to the hotcakes.
"I'm a really hypocritical socialist," he muttered to himself. "I like money way too much." They were out on the open deck, Jason working the grill as Humphrey sat at a nearby table, looking over the meticulous notes he had taken on the team's training. Winter was pleasant in Greenstone, with mild temperatures and less mugginess pressing in from the wet jungle delta, magically sustained in the middle of a bone-dry desert. The sky was a gorgeous empty blue, with a crystal clarity to the winter air that even the brightest summer day couldn't match.
"Looks like a nice one today," Jason said, looking up.
"You're right," Humphrey said.
"How about we do some outside training? Maybe focus on mobility training?"
"Works for me,"
Jason said.
"Did you schedule that matchup against Beth's team?"
"It won't be for a few days," Humphrey said. "We aren't the only ones in a training frenzy after the Reaper trials. The Mirage Chamber is heavily booked."
Like everyone who safely returned from the Reaper trials, the Geller family teams had brought back a treasure trove of Awakening Stones to unlock new magical abilities and complete their power sets. Danielle Geller had received the same forewarning as Jason had about the chance for unusual Awakening Stones. Most adventurers who faced the trials now had a Reaper ability in their repertoire, as almost everyone who survived had been awarded an otherwise extremely rare Awakening Stone of the Reaper. This included both Jason and Humphrey, with Jason having even picked up a second one. The rare stones didn't awaken inherently more powerful abilities, but having a little-known power in their toolkit could be a trump card for any adventurer. This slew of new and little-seen powers had excited Jason and Humphrey's teammate, Clive. As an enthusiastic proponent of the Magic Society's effort to catalogue all known powers, Clive and his dogged questions were now being actively avoided. He had also urged their teammate Belinda to shapeshift into Jason, in an attempt to replicate the interface power that allowed him to look at detailed descriptions of magical abilities. To his frustration, she always ended up with the wrong power and could only replicate Jason's map ability.
"The map is a great power," Jason had insisted, when Clive had complained to him.
"Not for administrative purposes," Clive had bemoaned.
I think you and I look at the potential of magic powers in very different ways, Jason told him. Humphrey and Jason chatted while going about their morning tasks, until Jason spotted a familiar but unexpected figure. She was walking along the marina pier towards the houseboat.
Humphrey, Jason said, your ex is coming by.
My ex? Humphrey asked.
He spotted Gabrielle as she approached the houseboat. Gabrielle Pellin was a priestess of the god of knowledge, as well as Humphrey's extremely beautiful ex-lover. Gabrielle and Jason had originally gotten along, but she wasn't the first person whose strong religious views had placed her in a position antagonistic to Jason. Jason regretted the part that played in souring Humphrey's relationship with her. He respected Humphrey for having the strength to end things with someone who stood out even in a world full of people made beautiful by magic. Jason doubted he could have made as mature a choice when he was 17. Jason invited Gabrielle aboard. The open deck areas of the houseboat didn't require the boat to take an aura imprint before granting access.
Gabrielle? Humphrey greeted, a complicated expression on his face.
Hello, Humphrey, she said.
Dressed in a plain version of the robes of her church, she was clearly trying to be stoic, but couldn't hide her tense body language. Steeling herself, she turned to Jason.
The goddess has a new gift for you, she said. I'm here to deliver it.
Is it strippers?
Jason asked. Not you, you're too young. Other strippers, but roughly the same level of hotness. Humphrey and Gabrielle both gave him horrified looks.
What?
He asked innocently.
Ignore him. My lady wants me to tell you that objectification jokes are beneath you,
Gabrielle said to Jason.
Yeah, Jason said with a chuckle. But you shouldn't trust someone who doesn't spend at least a little time in the gutter.
I very much disagree, Gabrielle said.
Colour me surprised. So, what does your boss have for me? I'll admit I'm a little trepidatious after the last time.
Jason had made a deal with the goddess of knowledge that she would give him a gift in return for not introducing his very poor grasp of the physical sciences into this one. Her first attempt at a gift was received as poorly as Jason understood the gravity he had tried to explain to Clive.
She recognized your concerns,
Gabrielle said, clearly unhappy,
and has prepared a new gift you should find more palatable. You should know that this gift edges against the boundaries of her own rules, consideration that you do not deserve.
What do you mean?
Gabrielle opened her dimensional satchel and pulled out books, one after another, piling them on the table next to Humphrey's notes.
This knowledge is the answer to a question you don't yet know to ask,
Gabrielle said as she continued taking out books.
This pushes the limits of what she is willing to do. Further, this knowledge is not of this world. She was reticent to give it to anyone, but you are not of this world either.
Not of this world? Humphrey asked.
The Builder cultists have been bestowed knowledge from beyond this reality, Gabrielle said. Now that it is here, she is sharing it with you.
Ah, Jason said. I know she likes this world to develop knowledge for itself, which is why she offered to bribe me in the first place. The Builder cult doesn't care about that, though, and now the genie's out of the bottle.
What would a genie be doing in a bottle?
Humphrey asked.
Wait, genies are a thing? Jason asked. Do they grant wishes?
No, that would be outrageous.
Do they grant wishes where you come from?
Just in stories, Jason said, then turned back to Gabrielle. So, this knowledge is something that comes from the Builder?
Yes. Once the knowledge was known by someone in this world, it became part of the goddess. She personally transcribed these tomes for delivery to you.
Humphrey's eyes went wide.
The goddess made these personally?
Yes, Gabrielle confirmed as she took out a small wooden case. She opened it to reveal neat rows of recording crystals.
She also created these and the information contained within. She would have produced all these as skill books that you could absorb more quickly, but knew you would reject them.
I would. Jason said. I won't imprint things directly into my mind that came from sources I don't entirely trust. So, what is all this knowledge?
The goddess recommends you turn to your friend Clive for assistance. She anticipates he will be quite enthusiastic.
He always is,
Jason said as he picked up a random book and opened it. It looked to be some kind of magical theory, at a level well above what he could pass at a glance. He closed the book and set it back down. "Thank you," he said. "I'm not really sure of the ramifications of this gift, but given the source, I expect it to be quite specifically useful." Gabrielle shook her head. "I am constantly at a loss as to why the goddess feels you warrant such consideration."
"You and me both, sister.
You want to stick around for pancakes?" Gabrielle gave Humphrey an uncertain glance, then shook her head. "I have further duties to attend to. I shall take my leave here."
Rufus stirred back to consciousness under the effect of his mother Arabelle's potent healing magic. He was lying on the sandy shore of the island where the group of adventurers had confronted the Builder cultists. The last thing he remembered was challenging a cultist far more powerful than himself, the man who killed Farah. He had put everything into one great blow, which had been almost but not quite enough. The last thing he remembered was falling unconscious, not expecting to ever wake up.
"We won then?" he groaned. "We were already on the way when we saw your field of darkness go up, and then that huge beam," his father said. "We finished off that silver ranker, but he was close to done when we found him. I pretty much just poked him, and he fell down dead."
Rufus closed his eyes and drew a sharp, ragged breath. The man, the inhuman thing, who killed Farah, was dead. Gabriel gave him a proud smile, placing a warm hand on Rufus's shoulder.
"You did it, son. Fantastic job."
"What your father means," Arabelle said, with a pointed look at Gabriel, "is that you never should have confronted an enemy like that."
"Exactly," Gabriel said. "Terrible job, son. Don't do it again."
Arabelle shook her head at her menfolk.
"I think it's time for another child, husband. A daughter this time."
"I'd love a little girl," Gabriel said. "What essence should we give her? How about a whip essence? I saw a student at the academy doing some very interesting things with one just recently."
"I think you're skipping a little far ahead, dear."
"What about the cultists?" Rufus asked.
"A lot of them made it through the portals,"
Callum said. Rufus hadn't even realized he was there, which was normal for the stealthy adventurer.
"We got most of the leadership,"
Callum continued.
"The count came up with one silver ranker less than my initial count, so they likely escaped amongst the lower rank masses."
"Prisoners?"
Rufus asked.
"None," Gabriel said. "The cultists did the usual self-detonating crystal star thing. Before they did that, though, they killed off the priests amongst them."
"Killing their own allies," Arabelle said, shaking her head. "I hate fighting zealots."
"We have plenty of recordings of Purity's clergy consorting with the cultists, though,"
Callum said.
"More than enough for the other churches to form an ecumenical council and forcibly investigate."
Rufus pushed himself to his feet.
"So, what now?"
he asked.
"Now we bring in everyone else. We need to identify the dead, see if it leads us to more cultists. Give the Magic Society a chance to figure out where these portals go. As for us, we can head back to the city."
For Jason and his team, days of unrelenting training turned into weeks as their potential slowly transmuted into capability. This included regular practice against other teams in the Mirage Chamber. Beth Cavendish's team was likewise improving rapidly, beating them less than half the time, but with only 5 members to the 6 on Jason's team. Padma was a half-disciple of Jason's dead friend Farah, with a team made up of Rufus's juniors from the Remor Academy. They were interested in testing themselves against Jason, the person Rufus and Farah had trained personally. At first, their conflicts were one-sided in favor of the Remor Academy elites, but Jason's team advanced in leaps and bounds until they were winning as much as they lost. Padma's team was standoffish at first, and all the more so after they rolled over Jason's team in their early encounters. They opened up as Jason and his team solidly proved their worth, although their draconian member remained stolid in his disdain for Humphrey and his dragon essence. Their shapeshifter, Natalie, struck up a friendship with Belinda, who had only gained her powers and joined the team after the Reaper trials.
Natalie was a valuable voice of experience for Belinda in the specialized area of shape-changing. Padma's team leader, in the meantime, built up a rivalry with Valdis. Both were sword specialists, with almost identical essence combinations, but they were very different swordsmen. Valdis had the classic combination of sword, swift, and adept, which produced the master confluence. Each essence was common, but with legends like Rufus's grandfather using the combination, no one would look down on it. Valdis was very much a swordsman of that tradition. He had an array of special attacks that, at a glance, seemed very similar. It was a high-skill power set that lived or died on the user's grasp of nuance. Lance, Padma's team leader, was an elf. His essences, which were sword, myriad, and adept, also produced the master confluence. He possessed the elven aptitude for spells, rather than the special attacks in which humans specialized, resulting in a wholly different combat style from Valdis. The elf could not match Valdis toe-to-toe, but he had no need to. He was far from weak in hand-to-hand combat, but his powers gave him the freedom to fight at any range. Mixing spells into his swordsmanship, he could duplicate himself, conjure dancing blades to fight for him, or fire waves of razor-sharp force from a distance. Of the two swordsmen, the more experienced Valdis edged out his opponent more often than not, although Lance would score his own points as well. Valdis and his team maintained a perfect record against Jason's in the Mirage Arena, although what began as a series of thrashings slowly became actual battles. To hear Valdis talk, however, enjoying post-fight drinks on the houseboat, anyone would think he was the one losing. "Your team is terrible to fight against," he said to Jason. "You're running around like an invisible teleporting plague, while your familiar is trying to burn down our healer. Normally, my job is to put down problems like that, but that damn woman is made of the wind. How does an immovable object move that quickly? That's not how immovable objects work." "You do realize you won, right?" Jason asked him. "She headbutted my sword. That shouldn't be possible. And what's with that woman who's everything? She had a wand in one hand and a shield in the other, which doesn't seem like something people should be allowed to do." "I'm pretty sure that's not a rule." "Once she hit me with my own power. My own power. Being able to take on different roles is one thing, but none of those roles should be me."
"Calm down," Sigrid told him. "You're spilling your drink."
In the wake of the Reaper trials, the city of Greenstone had a relative flood of essences and awakening stones. The foreign adventurers largely took their gains and went home, but many locals had also participated. Most had never intended to vie for the ultimate prize, but instead plundered the astral space for as much treasure as they could carry away. As a result, the market price of essences and stones reached an all-time low. With so many essences and awakening stones entering the market, Greenstone's novice adventurer population was undergoing a surge. Families that previously could only dream of having an adventurer in their ranks were pooling their resources to buy essence sets for their most promising young people. It made for a strong first step towards replenishing the numbers diminished by the losses of the disastrous expedition. The city's more powerful criminals were also taking the chance to add powerful henchmen to their rosters. The ramifications of the expedition to the astral space that claimed so many adventurers' lives were still being felt in the ongoing presence of the Adventure Society Inquiry. The inquiry had begun with sweeping demotions, after which they had put the branch records through a sieve, while so many adventurers were away at the Reaper trials. Once they returned, the inquiry commenced interviews, sometimes with individuals and other times with groups. Finally, the Adventure Society had started re-evaluations, assessing the demoted adventurers one by one to reinstate their rank, confirm the demotion, or even revoke their membership altogether. This brought a sense of hopelessness, but for most, their demotions were confirmed. When memberships were revoked, it was not a matter up for appeal. The lobbying to do so from certain sectors was swiftly and emphatically rebuffed. Other concerns were at a level that iron rankers like Jason and his team were uninvolved, although the team's connections kept them abreast of goings-on. The Builder cult was on the back foot, at least locally. The cult had been purged from the city and, after several costly ambushes, had halted their supply raids in the Delta. The escapees from the island raid were still at large, however. Stories rolled in of the cult's activities around the world, and tension built as the city awaited the revelation of their next big move.
The Church of Purity was under more scrutiny than any church would ordinarily have to tolerate. An ecumenical council of the other churches sanctioned them, launching a sweeping inquiry. Their temple was searched and all manner of materials seized. The church officially maintained that their members present at the island raid were a schism faction, denounced by their god. Claims of a few isolated bad apples rang hollow, however, as similar revelations were made about the Church of Purity all around the world. Certain individuals stood out, either by their absence or the issues in which current events embroiled them. A number of key members of the Church of Purity seemed to have vanished on previously scheduled sabbaticals. These absentees included the Church of Purity's Archbishop, Nicholas Hendren, Anissa LaSalle, and almost the entire LaSalle family, who were some of the Purity Church's strongest supporters. Those that remained claimed no knowledge of where their spiritual journeys had taken them. Jason was especially delighted to hear about Lucian Lamprey scrambling to absolve himself. Lamprey's personal intervention in handing the star seed over to the Church of Purity was suddenly the object of significant scrutiny. The time-displaced priests Jason had released from the astral space during the Reaper trials were an unusual new presence in the city. Most were absorbed into their various churches, but the former members of the Church of Purity were another matter, having been rejected by their now former god. As Jason predicted, the Adventure Society had taken their disposition in hand. Given the troubles faced by the church that rejected them, the priests were a rather awkward presence within the city. Those priests who had some of their powers gifted to them by their god had those powers revoked, which left them with dangerously imbalanced power. Those who had the greatest level of power and those who had many of their powers revoked suffered the worst. Until they replaced the missing powers, they would all suffer, and their strength would never return to its previous level unless they found a new god to replace their missing abilities. One group of the former purists dedicated themselves to regaining entry to the Church of Purity. They were undaunted by the new revelations about their church, but their dedication was flatly rebuffed. A small number of these even turned to suicide in their despair, rather than accept exclusion. Others sought positions in other churches, many finding success. The rest eventually came to accept the need to start over and accepted new ordinary essences. With the market at record lows, the Adventure Society provided common essences for free as an act of mercy. Whatever their situation and whatever their faith, every member now freed from the astral space had to decide on their own future. They had all been born before Greenstone was founded, and needed to find a new way in what was to them a new world. Everyone they had known and loved was long gone. Most took passage to their homelands, even knowing that there was no one and nothing waiting for them. The priests whose gods had welcomed them back at least had a path. Their churches placed them locally or sent them off to distant branches of their faith. Others, mostly former purists who came to accept their abandonment, decided to start over in Greenstone. They took the essences they were offered, even if they were cheap and less than ideal. Many, purist and otherwise, rejected their former faith with ferocity. They were filled with resentment at the gods who had sent them into that place and cost them everything and everyone they had known. They had a new attitude towards the gods that made Jason seem pious by comparison. All the recovered clergy, excommunicated or not, had a variety of attitudes towards Jason. As he was the agent of their liberation, they were largely grateful, although to wildly varying degrees. Some felt that he only released them as an afterthought. Some even resented him for their current situation. Most were more gracious, however, often thanking him in person as he wandered about the Adventure Society campus. There was even a small contingent of the freed priests who viewed him as their savior, especially after the gods had publicly appeared to thank him in person. One day, Jason and his team returned from their training to find Rufus drinking out on the deck of the houseboat with Vincent, the Adventure Society official with the outrageous mustache. The pair had previously maintained a casual relationship, although not as much since Farrah's death. Vincent's busy schedule and Rufus's driving obsession had left them seeing little of one another. After confronting Farrah's killer and being largely responsible for his death, Rufus was finally starting to move forward. They were not alone. Gary and his friend Russell, an artificer from the Magic Society, sat with them. "Jason," Vincent greeted. "Your reassessment interview with the Adventure Society has been scheduled. I thought I'd come and tell you in person." "All right," Jason said. Any idea if I'll be getting my old rank back?
The issue is that you're very loud for an iron ranker, Vincent said. They're going to want a display of humility.
No worries, Jason said. No one's as good at being humble as me.